Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is the USS Hamlet's Father's Ghost requesting entry into Uranian orbit and the Uranian satellite system. We have decelerated and seek clearance to Titanium.
Greetings, USS Hamlet's Father's Ghost. This is Mustard Seed. Can you state the purpose of your visit?
Roger that, Mustard Seed. I have 250 Shakespeare enthusiasts on board just waking up for a tour of the Uranian moons. Our visit to the Royal Automated Uranium Theater on Titania should be registered in the log.
All right, roger that. USS HFG, I can confirm your reservation now, and docking credentials are good to go. Wish your passengers a pleasant and safe visit to the Uranian satellite system. The next automated thespianoid performance will be, let's see... Ooh, Edward III. Well, better luck next time.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our series on the planet Uranus and its moons. Now, in part one, we focused mainly on the planet itself. This time, we're going to start getting more into the moons. Maybe we'll do all of the moons this time. I think last time we promised it would happen. We'll see whether we can fit it all into one episode. But I had a few more core planet digressions burning a hole in my pocket that I wanted to mention before we fly off to the satellites. Are you okay with that, Rob?
Let's do it.
So first of all, I was wondering, what's the density of Uranus? And it turns out that Uranus is the second least dense planet in the solar system at 1.27 grams per cubic centimeter. The only planet less dense is actually Saturn, the second largest planet in the solar system. You might wonder, which planet is the densest, baby? That's Earth. That's Earth. We are at 5.51 grams per cubic centimeter. So we are the density king. But one of the real things I wanted to return to was a question of materials, because in the last episode, we mentioned, just giving sort of an overview of the basics of the planet, that most of the mass of Uranus is thought to be a hot, dense fluid of ices, probably surrounding a rocky core of some sort. And though it might be kind of strange to hear, like, hot, dense fluid of ices, that almost kind of doesn't make sense based on our definition of ice. And it's true that a lot of this ice is going to be different than the kind of ice we know. So I was reading more about this in an article by a planetary atmosphere scientist named Amy Simon, who is a senior researcher at NASA Goddard. And this was written for the magazine of the Planetary Society. The article was called The Realm of the Ice Giants. And one of the questions Simon addresses in this article is, why are the planets Uranus and Neptune called ice giants as opposed to regular gas giants. It's because compared to regular gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune are composed of a higher proportion of ice-forming molecules like water and methane, though much of that so-called ice is in a phase unfamiliar to us on the surface of Earth. Simon writes, quote, "Ice giants are mostly water, probably in the form of a supercritical fluid. The visible clouds likely consist of ice crystals with different compositions." So regarding supercritical fluid, a supercritical fluid doesn't behave exactly like a liquid, a gas, or a solid. It's an emergent state of matter occurring at temperatures and pressures beyond what is known as the critical point for each substance. And Simon has a very good paragraph clarifying the planetary science use of the term ice, which could help clear up any confusion there. She says that on Earth, we usually use the term ice to refer to just water, H2O, when it is frozen solid. But planetary astronomers use the word ice to refer to any condensable molecule in its solid form. She writes, quote, "These tend to be highly reflective, form clouds, and, unlike minerals, can readily change between liquid, solid, and gas states at relatively low temperatures." So we're mainly familiar with water ice on the surface of Earth, but throughout space, there are lots of ices. There's methane, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and phosphine, pH 3. And these are all condensable molecules and could all freeze in the atmosphere of Uranus and Neptune also, for that matter. And Simon writes that most of the clouds we see in the atmospheres of these ice giants are clouds of methane ice crystals or hydrogen sulfide ice. So there's probably weird supercritical fluids down below and then an atmosphere above. The atmosphere in its gas contents is mostly hydrogen and helium, but that atmosphere is probably full of traces of different kinds of ice, including not just H2O, but things like ammonia and methane. And speaking of methane, as we mentioned last time, the blue color of both Neptune and Uranus appears to come from the presence of methane in their atmospheres, which absorbs the red wavelengths of light from the sun and reflects only the blue spectrum. But the question is, why is Uranus a paler shade of blue than Neptune? If you look at Neptune, it's often kind of a royal blue, whereas in true color, Uranus appears kind of a gray-green blue. Simon writes that this is, quote, "either because Uranus has more haze, so more kind of a cloudy outer shell, but she goes on, or because Neptune's atmosphere has another unidentified constituent that absorbs longer wavelength light even more strongly." And of course, longer wavelength light would be more redshifted toward the red end of the visible spectrum. Okay, so that's ice, the atmosphere, the makeup of the planet. But there's one more thing you may have seen headlines about regarding Uranus and Neptune that if you have seen these headlines, I'm sure you're wondering about it. And that is the claim that some experts have argued that it likely rains diamonds on Uranus and Neptune. And from what I can tell, this is true. Now, this is obviously something we haven't been able to detect directly with probes or anything, so nobody can sense this happening. Instead, it's based on what we do know about the planets and argue and sort of extrapolating logically from those starting facts. So how does the logic go? Well, I was reading about this in an article for space.com by the SUNY Stony Brook astrophysicist Paul M. Sutter. And in this article, Sutter explains that we know from mathematical models that the inner mantles of ice giants probably have temperatures of about 7,000 kelvins, or over 6,700 Celsius, and pressure about 6 million times the atmospheric pressure on the surface of Earth. Meanwhile, higher up in the mantle, things are cooler, about 2,000 kelvins and only 200,000 times Earth's atmospheric pressure. And we know that water, ammonia, and methane are present within that mantle. So what happens to those substances in those conditions? Well, these conditions of temperature and pressure would tend to tear apart molecules of methane. Methane is CH4, carbon and hydrogen. And when those molecules get torn apart, we are left with free carbon. Free carbon tends to link together with other free carbon to form long chains of carbon. What happens to long chains of pure carbon under high pressure? That gets pressed into a diamond. These diamonds would tend to then drop down to lower in the mantle, where high temperatures vaporize them, and then they float back up into the upper mantle, and then the cycle repeats. So you're left with diamond rain. Sounds like the name of a great alternate universe, collaborative sci-fi movie musical between Prince and David Bowie. Wish I could have seen it, but it does appear to be very likely a physical reality on Uranus and Neptune as well.
So you're saying that all we have to do is jet out to Uranus, dip down into the atmosphere of Uranus, scoop up some diamonds, then get back to Earth, and we're set for life.
I've always said when I look up at the stars at night, what I see is profit. Okay, but one more digression before we get to the moons. Since part one, we actually got a really great bit of listener mail from Joe, not me, but a different Joe who listens to the show, who brought to our attention some really awesome photos of Uranus recently captured by the James Webb Space Telescope. Joe writes, quote, "I've long awaited with tremulous anticipation the resumption of your aural journey to the heliopause and was thrilled to see the recumbent Sky King Uranus on my podcast feed. Your choice was timely indeed, as the James Webb Space Telescope just last month released some spectacular visuals of Uranus. These images boast greater clarity than the Hubble's effort, especially of the planet's rings. I love living under a sky that will never run out of extraordinary things to look at and talk about, and I appreciate when you cast your gaze upward from time to time, Joe." Well, thank you, Joe, because I had not seen these. I looked them up, and this is fantastic. So this I saw these within the context of a NASA press release from April 6th, 2023 that Joe shared with us. Rob, I pasted these two photos here in the outline. One is just zoomed in on the planet from the more zoomed out second one. I say, from my perspective, these images are gorgeous. They fill one with awe at the picture of this frosty dark recess where the blue god lives. And this might sound a little bit weird, but I actually mean this in the best possible way. Somehow in these images, Uranus looks more like an optical artifact than a physical object, as if the planet were like a glint or a lens flare. And to explain what I mean, so the planet is pictured on its side, because of course that's how it is. We're not seeing the rings laterally from the side crossing over and behind the planet like we do in most photos of Saturn. Instead, we're seeing the rings encircling the planet in an egg shape because we're looking roughly down toward the North Pole, which faces sideways. And in this particular photo, though this is not exactly true color, the planet is pale blue with a white cap, and the rings sort of fade outward to inward from a screaming fluorescent white to a dim blue-gray as they sink toward the planet's atmosphere. And the sunlight seems blinding in these images because we actually see it gleaming off the edge of the planet, which is even weirder because, as I said, the disk of Uranus facing us looks like a glint or a gleam itself. And in the more zoomed out of these two photos, we can see the blue dots of the larger moons surrounding it, also sending out these sort of shafts of reflected light in these hexagonal crisscrosses out into space.
Yeah, these images are gorgeous. It makes it look like Uranus is a planet designed by Japanese illustrator Hajime Soriyama. Who's, of course, I think he worked on the design for the original Sony AIBO robot, but also mostly known for robot pinup, like really shiny, silvery robot pinup models. This artist is on my mind because the movie we're watching Friday in for Weird House Cinema, this artist is credited like deep down in the credits because there's a character in the movie that has some of this art up on his workstation.
Oh, that's funny.
But,
But this kind of, but there's a certain, aside from like the female robot bodies in his art, there is this kind of like glimmering, like silvery perfection to things. And that's what I kind of get from this image of Uranus. And if you're into planets, like, I mean, put it on a calendar. It looks nice.
It is beautiful. And I will say the blue in this photo, as I alluded to, is not exactly true color from the visible spectrum. I think it's approximate. So the image is from the Webb's near infrared camera, combining data from two filters. According to the press release, it was 1.4 and 3.0 microns. And then the article explains these are coded out to blue and orange, respectively. Now, I mentioned the white cap that we see on Uranus in this photo. The article explains that this is known as the polar cap, and it seems to manifest when the pole of the planet goes into direct sunlight during its long polar summer, which, again, as we talked about last time, lasts many Earth years at a time. And then the cap seems to disappear in the fall when it starts to turn away from the sun. As far as I could find, we aren't sure exactly what causes this, or maybe if somebody knows, I just didn't dig that up. But so regarding the beautiful rings in the picture, Uranus has 13 known rings, and you can see 11 of them in this photo, though some of them are so bright that they bleed together in the image. There are 9 major rings, and then there are 2 kind of faint, dusty rings that were discovered during the approach of Voyager 2 in 1986. But speaking of those rings and moons sometimes have an interesting origin story. So I was wondering, where do experts generally think they came from in the case of Uranus? Going back to that Planetary Society article by Amy Simon, Simon writes that the medium-sized moons of Uranus probably formed in place at the same time or after whatever event it was that left Uranus tilted on its side. And as we talked about last time, it seems likely that Uranus was probably knocked on its side and left colder than all the other planets because of an impact with a large object, maybe like an Earth-sized planet, billions of years ago. And so what we're left with is that the moons orbit Uranus on its equatorial plane. So like the planet itself and like its rings, the moons are tilted at a roughly 90-degree angle to the rest of the solar system. In general, the moons of Uranus are made of ice and rock, usually slightly more ice than rock, and they show some interesting surface features, like patterns of darkening on their surfaces that are caused by some unknown material. Spectral analysis reveals the presence of frozen carbon dioxide on a lot of the moons. Meanwhile, the origin of the rings, the consensus seems to be that they are created by the shattering into dust and fragments of formerly solid moons. And as we've seen with other planets, the sudden or gradual smash up of moons can happen a number of ways, by, you know, lots of little collisions with meteoroids or other objects, or by tidal breakup due to gravity. In any case, turning former larger satellites into smaller satellites and rings of little fragments.
Yeah, it's fascinating how, from our human perspective, we look up at our moon, we consider the moons of other worlds, and there's a certain stability to them, you know. But if you look at any planet's moons or moon, generally you're looking at a more violent relationship over the vast history of a given planet. There's nothing peaceful about it.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, well, let's begin, at least begin to dip into the moons of Uranus. Like I say, we originally set out to do them all. Maybe we won't do them all. Maybe we'll get partway through the journey and we'll come back on Tuesday. Who knows? Maybe we'll just get into, we'll finish them up and then we'll go right into Neptune. There are no rules. We can do what we want. So let's start with the inner moons of Uranus, 13 total known. All right, we're going to start with a pair of moons, Cordelia and Ophelia. These are named for the youngest daughter of King Lear and, of course, Hamlet's tragic beloved, respectively. The main significance of these moons is that both Cordelia and Ophelia are shepherd moons, as their gravity keeps Uranus's epsilon ring from dispersing.
Now, I thought this was interesting, so I was looking up how exactly it is that shepherd moons work. What does the shepherd moon do, these little small moons? How do they keep a ring? Essentially, they keep a ring in tight formation around the planet and clear these gaps between the rings. Hmm. And it seems that essentially it works like this. So you've got a small moon and it's orbiting the planet. And imagine at first it's orbiting the planet along with a bunch of other small particles. Sort of within the lane of that small moon's orbit, particles that are ahead of the small moon will be attracted by gravity to it. Meaning if they're orbiting ahead of it, they will naturally want to slow down in their orbit, right? Because they're getting pulled toward this moon. But slowing down in their orbit actually causes them to lose energy and fall down closer to the planet that they're orbiting. Mm. So these like dust and particles and things in the ring actually end up sorting down into lower orbit rings. And then meanwhile, things that are orbiting along the same lane as this moon that are behind it in its orbit are attracted to it and thus sped up. And as they get sped up, trying to chase after this moon by the force of gravity, that acceleration actually causes them to have greater energy and to ascend in their orbit and end up going into outer rings beyond that little moon.
So again, we have the shepherd moons here. They were discovered by Voyager 2 in 1986.
Like the rest of Uranus's inner moons, they appear to be roughly equal split of water, ice, and rock. They're small. Of note, Cordelia is the closest to the planet. And I guess we should also point out or come back to the fact that, yes, these are both Shakespearean references. There are going to be a lot of Shakespeare references as we go through the moons of Uranus. And these are just the first two.
It seems that a lot of the names of these satellites, for some reason, were chosen either from the works of Shakespeare or from the works of Alexander Pope.
Yeah, predominantly Shakespearean, but definitely there's some key Alexander Pope references as well. So as we go through it, we're going to probably talk a little bit about some of the namesakes here.
Well, this was something I was wondering. I don't know about the origin exactly, like what people had in mind when they were naming these. But so I think, like, is there some significance to the innermost minor moon here being called Cordelia? Because Cordelia is a very poignant character. Cordelia is the youngest daughter of King Lear in the play King Lear. If you don't know the play or need refreshing, the very beginning of it, the first scene is King Lear is this old king. He comes out, he decides that he will divide up his kingdom between his three daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia. And he's going to give the largest portion to the daughter that loves him most. So Goneril and Regan give these speeches where they overwhelm their father with absurd, insincere flattery about how much they love him. And then when it's Cordelia's time to speak, she finds that she cannot put into words. She cannot express her love for her father. To herself, she says that she knows her love is richer than her tongue. And then when it's her time to speak, she says, "Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less." And I think he gives her a chance to amend her statement. She doesn't really. And then so Lear gets furious at this, decides to disinherit her. He gives nothing to Cordelia, splits his kingdom between the other two daughters, Goneril and Regan, who secretly think he is a fool, and they will go on to betray him once they come to power. And of course, it's a tragedy, so things just get worse and worse. Basically, everybody ends up dead. But, you know, it's a very meaningful character and something I think, I don't know, that moment in the first scene is something that always got me, something I can really relate to, like the feeling of worrying that you don't express positive feelings because you're afraid that you can't phrase them in the sincerest way, like you don't know how to put them to words, so then you worry that like you're perceived as not wanting to say a positive thing at all. I don't know if that makes sense.
No. I mean, certainly with the example here from the play, absolutely.
But she's the daughter that truly loved him. She just, didn't want to give a big insincere speech. Anyway, it's a very meaningful character. So I'm wondering, is there some simile at play here in the selection of the name for this moon? Maybe not. So like, it's a very small satellite. It's the closest to the planet of these. It is one of the shepherd moons that sort of guides the Epsilon ring and keeps it tight in formation. By the end, I mean, she does show great discipline because she comes back with an army to try to fight on her father's side against her cruel, duplicitous sisters. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know if it fits, but I was wondering.
No, I think it's natural to try and read some sort of sense into the naming, though, of course, as we'll discuss, it's different people at different times coming up with these names. You know, some are maybe probably a little more up on the works of William Shakespeare than others. Sometimes there seems like something they could be getting at, other times not. And also some of these kind of slip by on a technicality. So they're kind of all over the place. All right, let's go on to the next one. There's Bianca, named after Kate's sister in The Taming of the Shrew. This one, there's nothing really else that I think is significant about it. And it was also discovered by Voyager 2. All right, after that, we have Cressida. This is the title character from Troilus and Cressida. Again, nothing other else that's really significant about this moon. It was also discovered by Voyager 2. I know some of you are probably wondering, when's Voyager 6 going to show up in all this? But I guess Voyager 6 just shot right out there, right?
I was unsure, but wait, you're referring to V'ger here, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, Voyager 6 doesn't actually exist, except in the world of Star Trek.
Okay.
Specifically Star Trek, the motion picture.
The most riveting of all of them.
That was penned by Alan Dean Foster.
Oh, wait, was he the one who wrote the novelization of Halloween 3 or something like that?
He wrote the novelization of most films, yes. All right, the next moon of note here is Desdemona. This one's named after the wife of Othello. No other real significance, once again, discovered by Voyager 2. All right, now we're moving on to another one. This is Juliet, or Juliet, right? If you're depending on how you're, what line from the play you're using, sometimes you get a hit. Two syllables instead of three on that. This is, of course, named after the title character from Romeo and Juliet. Romeo, meanwhile, is nowhere to be found amid the moons of Uranus. It is kind of interesting that there's a part in Romeo and Juliet where Romeo is swearing his love up and down the universe, and Juliet specifically asks him not to swear by the moon. Mm. She says, quote, "Oh, swear not by the moon, the inconstant moon, that monthly changes in her circle orb, lest that thy love prove likewise variable."
Changes in her circle orb. What does that refer to, like the waxing and waning of the moon? Or maybe, I'm not sure I know what that means.
I mean, I take it to mean, yeah, it's like there are different phases of the moon. Like if your love is like the moon, Romeo, then I don't, you know, it's like, what am I going to get today? I mean, it seems like okay. if it is like the moon, she could chart it out and then she'd have a really good idea of what she's going to get, you know, yeah. Phase by phase. But yeah, she's like, I need consistency.
Right. Your love should not wax and wane. We shouldn't have a new moon of your love.
Yes.
It's werewolf night every night.
Yeah. Anyway, aside from these thoughts, Juliet, nothing else that's really significant. Once again, discovered by Voyager 2. Then we have Portia. This one is named after the heroine from The Merchant of Venice. This one, I guess the main significance is that it orbits Uranus in less than one Earth day, and it was discovered by Voyager 2.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay. Picture this, it's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, up next we have Rosalind. Rosalind is one of the Duke's daughters in As You Like It. That's the namesake. Nothing else really significant to discuss here. This one was also discovered by Voyager 2. All right, the next one is Cupid. This one is a tough one to fit in, but okay, Cupid is of course the Roman god of love.
Character famously invented by William Shakespeare.
Well, he is technically a character in Shakespeare's, what is it, Timon of Athens? I'm not familiar with this play.
I don't know anything about that one.
This may be one of the more obscure ones. I don't remember studying this one in school. But the discovery of it is kind of interesting because it was discovered by M.R. Showalter and J.J. Lissauer using the Hubble Space Telescope in 2003. It was too small and too dark for Voyager 2 to spot. And I was thinking about this. It's tempting to try and spin this one out and think of like, okay, here we have Cupid as this dark, near invisible shadow presence, you know, reminding us of past discussions about how Cupid was sometimes said to shoot lead in arrows. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, he's not only dealing out love with his projectiles, but also some of the ramifications of love and maybe even the tragic ramifications of love. Again, this one seems to sort of slip by on a technicality in terms of its naming. All right. The next one is Belinda. And this is one where we have to ask Shakespeare to move over because this one is named after the character whose lock of hair is stolen in Alexander Pope's Rape of the Lock.
Now, this is an unfortunately titled poem because it doesn't mean what it sounds like. The poem by Pope is an older definition of the word rape, which is basically, in this context, it means like theft or snatching. So the poem is a mock heroic satire. It narrates like a social scandal in which a lord of some sort, I did read this in school, I forget a lot of the details, but he like steals a lock of hair from a young woman, but it's written like in the style of the Iliad to be mocking of the like, oh, ho, ho, this is actually insignificant. I think Pope's point is best summarized in one of its lines where he says, what mighty contests rise from trivial things. Though, I don't know, thinking back on it now, there are obviously much worse crimes, but stealing somebody's hair is pretty weird.
Yeah, and plus hair has magical connotations. They could be stealing it to work some sort of magic. Maybe that's explored in the poem. I don't know. I have a degree in English, and I somehow managed to never read this poem. I remember that, you know, of course, I'm familiar with the author's name and his popularity and importance in English literature. But I remember this title would come up, and I would think, oh, that doesn't sound like something I want to read, not realizing that it's about hair theft.
Alexander Pope. Everything I recall that he wrote is basically satirical in nature. I'm sure he must have written serious poems, but like the other main thing I remember he wrote is something called the Dunciad, which is a sort of an epic poem about stupidity.
Mm.
He was like, it seems like he was just really into not suffering fools. Though I feel like if that's your main vibe, you really open yourself up to scrutiny, don't you?
Yeah. All right, well, we'll come back to Pope's work in a bit because there are more moons named after him. The next one is Perdita, and this is the daughter of Leontes and Hermione in William Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. This one's discovery is actually pretty interesting because Voyager 2 is involved in its discovery, but it wasn't recognized till 2003. Basically, University of Arizona's Eric Karkoschka discovered it by comparing Voyager 2 imagery with Hubble imagery and sort of working out its existence based on these two different streams.
Hmm.
All right, up next we have Puck. Puck is, of course, named after the sprite from A Midsummer Night's Dream. Stanley Tucci played him in the 1999 film adaptation, which had a great cast. I do remember seeing this film when it came out. And I imagine I've seen multiple. It seems like Midsummer Night's Dream is just one of those plays that
you're just going to fall into seeing it, even if you don't set out to watch Shakespeare in life.
Puck's a great character, great mischief maker. The mischief maker who brings wisdom, whether on purpose or not.
Yeah, yeah. Tucci was perfect casting. Now, significance here is that it's the smallest of the inner moons, with a diameter of about 150 kilometers or about 90 miles. And it was, guess what, discovered by Voyager 2. All right, up next we have Mab. It's named after Queen Mab, queen of the fair folk in English folklore. She's mentioned in Romeo and Juliet, so just mentioned. So it just really, really squeaks by on a technicality. I mean, this is one of those situations where I feel like I want to shout a little bit and be like, look, there are a lot of names that are mentioned in Shakespeare, and there are plenty of characters. I don't know why Queen Mab seems like the ideal choice here.
Is there an inner moon named Julius Caesar?
No. But, you know, you could. That would have been a good one, Caesar, right? But that's just off the top of my head. I'm not sure if there's some other... I should also point out, when you start looking, and I didn't get into this in any of my note-taking, really, but there are individual features on some moons that are likewise named after other things. So there could be a Caesar in there somewhere.
You know what? Actually, I want to be fair. Even a lot of the Shakespeare characters that we think of as more original Shakespeare characters are actually often from like adapted versions of pre-existing tales. Like a lot of Shakespeare's plays were not wholly made up stories. They were based on something from history or from an older story or another play or something.
Right, right.
Like who would have thought that, you know, Hamlet is the guy from The Northman.
Yeah, I mean, if he were around today, he'd be, he'd be in the MCU somewhere working on a project. But anyway, Mab is the moon here. This one was discovered in 2003 by Showalter and Lissauer using the Hubble Space Telescope.
Interesting fact I came across while reading that article by the NASA Goddard researcher Amy Simon. She writes that Mab, quote, may be generating a tenuous blue-toned ring like Enceladus does for Saturn's E ring, though the source currently remains a mystery.
Well, you know, that sounds kind of fitting for the queen of the fairy folk, so I do like that.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and do you know what the clock reads? It reads A Promise Broken, because we said we were going to do all of the moons within part two, and I think we have failed, because we're coming up against a time limit. We got to cap it here, and we've got all of the major moons left to talk about, so I think that's going to have to be part three of our series on Uranus and its satellites.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully we didn't mess anybody up there, but I think the journey will be better for breaking into three parts here. So, and there's going to be a lot of fun stuff to talk about, especially with the major moons of Uranus. And then, yeah, getting also into just some of the additional Shakespearean references in the naming of these moons. In the meantime, if you would like to catch up on past episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, including our past episodes dealing with the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Mars and so forth, you'll find those in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, which you'll find wherever you get your podcasts. We have core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind airing there on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we open up the mailbag on our listener mail episodes. That's primarily where we read emails from people. Occasionally, we'll read one in an episode, as in today's episode, if it relates to the subject matter. But generally, it's going to be in the Monday episodes. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact episode. This week, of course, it ties into our theme of Uranus. So go check that out if you haven't. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. Our selection for this week does not have anything to do with the planet Uranus, but it's still a lot of fun.
By God, we'll find a way to tie it in by the time Friday comes around.
Yeah, we'll see.
Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Is getting gas at Exxon burning a hole in your wallet? Get the Drop app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards just by filling up your tank. Download Drop now. Use code DROP66 to instantly receive $5 in points.
Since every minute counts when you're a new parent, who wants to waste time washing bottles? Transform this daily chore with the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro, the first machine that automatically washes, sterilizes, and dries bottles, pump parts, and sippy cups at the push of a button. Its 20 spray jets clean everything 100%. Plus, it sterilizes with steam, then dries with germ-free air. Don't waste time on tedious hand-washing. Let the Baby Brezza Bottle Washer Pro do it for you. Shop now at babybrezza.com.